Hello and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about Satan.
Yes, Satan, not Satan.
Not Satan.
No.
Different thing.
Very different.
Probably not vegetarian, that second one.
I don't think so. But you never know. You never know. No, we're talking about Satan, which is flavored wheat gluten, sometimes called gluten, wheat protein, or wheat meat. It's in your tofurkey slices.
Yes.
Yes. But really, though, what is it?
Okay. Seitan is a protein product created using wheat gluten. Gluten is the primary protein in wheat. It's a stretchy and sort of linky. And the texture of seitan is, well, it's a lot like meat, maybe more so than other meat alternatives. It has a sort of fibrous chew that reminds me a lot of chicken, or at least like a chicken nugget, if not actual chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And you make seitan by first coaxing the gluten out of wheat flour, and then by encouraging that gluten to lock up just right to give you that nice chewy texture. To get the gluten out, you make a sort of dough of flour and water, and then soak and knead it with more water, like a lot more water. Gluten is not water-soluble, so it will stay put in your sort of dough. But the starches that make up the rest of wheat flour are totally water-soluble, so they will eventually wash out. You're then left with gluten. And, okay, gluten is made up of two types of protein molecules, glutenins and gliadins, plus a smattering of a few other compounds like cysteine, which is an amino acid. And, all right, under normal circumstances, gluten is a sort of gel-like suspension of this stuff and maybe some molecules of water. But when you mess with it, both physically mixing or kneading the gluten and also chemically changing its pH by adding stuff like vinegar or baking soda, those cysteines will make the glutenin molecules link up. The gliadins are smaller and will get trapped in these like cross-linked matrices of gluten molecules. Imagine. You have a few strands of giant Christmas lights.
Oh, I do.
Like the bulbs are like the size of like normal lamp bulbs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And these strands are just super tangled up.
Oh, no.
As they do. And for some reason, you and all your wisdom decided to store a bunch of bitty little like pinky-sized globe ornaments in the same box as these strands of Christmas lights. And so, when you take this mass of tangled lights out of the box, all of these little ornaments come with it, trapped in the little, like, pockets made up by the twisted cords.
Did my mom put you up to this? Like, it's a lot of work taking down the decorations at the end of the year, Mom.
No shame. Okay, does this imagine that you can eat it?
Oh.
Does that make it better?
Then I don't have to untangle them.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's seitan.
Cool. Guilt-free. You can also make it at home.
It is notoriously difficult to get the texture right. But yes, you can totally work your own gluten out of flour or buy wheat gluten, often called vital wheat gluten in stores, and use it to make your own seitan. You can also use vital wheat gluten to up your homemade bread game.
Ooh, I'm always looking to up my homemade bread game.
Oh.
If we're talking about flavor, I actually don't have too much experience with seitan. Satan? Yes. In the form of horror movies. But seitan? No, not really. I do remember it having a hearty, meaty texture and that it absorbed flavor really well. It can mimic some of the flavors and properties of meat so well that it makes some vegetarians or vegans suspicious that there might actually be meat in whatever vegetarian-vegan dish they've ordered that has seitan in it.
Yeah, by itself, wheat gluten is pretty bland, but seitan is usually made with flavor additives to make it taste meaty. Common recipes recommend savory things like nutritional yeast, tamari, and Worcestershire sauce.
And if we're talking about nutrition, seitan has a good amount of protein. 1 ounce comes in around 21 grams of protein. It's low fat, low carb, but obviously not gluten-free if celiacs or gluten intolerance is something that you deal with.
And this package of really high protein with really low fat and low carb is something that some people find very desirable.
Mm-hmm. And numbers-wise, in 2012, some research put the meat alternatives industry in the U.S., of which seitan is a part of, at $533 million. So it's making some money.
Yeah.
It's making some money. And if we look back at the history, It features a cameo from someone I was not expecting that we haven't talked about in a while on this show. But you're going to have to wait to find out who it is until after this quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
For centuries, Chinese and Japanese vegetarian Buddhist monks have eaten seitan.
Or not exactly seitan, but hu, romanized either H-U or F-U. But yeah, hu is not exactly what we think of when we think of seitan today, but is also a product made from wheat gluten that has been processed to form chewy, proteiny products. It's usually a little less fibrous than seitan, more like the texture of seafood than chicken, or sort of spongier, like a sort of springy cake.
Yeah, there isn't too much when it comes to history, recorded history, when it comes to seitan. But I do know that some people, like, ignore this whole thing and say that this isn't seitan when they're talking about the history of seitan.
Yeah.
Depends, you know, mysteries of history.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's been a Southeast Asian diet staple since 6th century CE. In Japan, for instance, where for centuries up until the 19th century, eating four-legged animals was forbidden.
This resulted from the arrival of Buddhism circa 6th century CE, compounding existing Shinto beliefs against killing or eating animals.
Because of that, Japan and also India, which had a similar story, the idea of mock meat wasn't really a thing for a good while because there wasn't really a reference point.
Yeah, there were pockets of cultures that ate meat anyway in Japan, but it was not widespread. Like, new emperors had a longstanding tradition of, as soon as they rose to power, re-upping that edict against eating mammals.
Right. The same wasn't true in China.
Not for the common person, at any rate. Buddhist monks on the mainland and in Korea wouldn't eat animals either.
Poet Yuan Mei included a recipe for a seitan textured to be similar to goose in the book Recipes from the Sui Garden. Journey to the West, a book out of the Ming Dynasty, comes with several wheat and gluten mentions. One involves a demon trying to trick a monk into eating human flesh and brains that resembled wheat gluten.
Oh, tricky demons.
I know, that sounds like it could be a future fantasy food
episode. Journey to the West is full of, it's the legend that we got so many other stories out of, like a Dragon Ball Z and Sayuki and all of these weird properties.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, revisit that for sure.
Yeah. Hu, or, you know, whatever precursor to seitan you want to talk about, did feature pretty widely in Chinese art. There's a poem from the 11th century CE book Dream Pool Essays that said, "Steel is to iron as gluten is to flour. It is only after thoroughly washing the dough that gluten is revealed."
Wow. Kind of want to go think about that for a minute. But I suppose we should continue.
Yeah.
In 1895, vegetarian restaurant number one opened in New York thanks to the New York City Vegetarian Society.
Vegetarian restaurant number one. I love how on the nose that is.
We have a restaurant similar to that in Atlanta. It was similarly named. But the opening night menu included fruit and graham bread. Yes, that graham bread. But that's not the cameo I'm talking about, although related. George Osawa came up with the term seitan in 1961. He was also the founder of the macrobiotic diet. And indeed, seitan wasn't that common in cookbooks until the 1970s, that word anyway. And like I said earlier, all of that early history we've been talking about, some folks dispute it, saying that seitan got its start with the macrobiotic diet in the 1960s.
I think seitan is based very heavily on hu. Like, to the point where you can really call it, I mean, that you can count the history of hu.
Yeah, it was sort of like a progression.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just an offshoot.
Yeah, I agree. When Mormon settlers were making their way to Utah in the 19th century, they needed an inexpensive protein source, and seitan was their answer. Oh, and also, you know who was a huge part of this movement? One John Harvey Kellogg.
Kellogg?
That Kellogg. As part of his whole health sanitarium thing that we've talked about in a few episodes, he was looking for a successful meat alternative for the vegetarians in his flock. He and his brother Wilkie, through some weird circumstance, came upon the conclusion that dry wheat flaked super well. And you add milk, voila, toasted wheat flakes. Now, Kellogg and his brother, Will Keith, had a huge blowout when it came to the profitability of the cereal, eventually leading to Will spinning out the Kellogg we all know, that company, and John Harvey Kellogg starting the Battle Creek Food Company. This company's product line was primarily mock meats, the most popular of which was known as Protos. It was a combination of soy, peanuts, and wheat gluten. Sort of the first commercial approximation of seitan.
Yeah.
Some Seventh-day Adventist fans of Kellogg's got the idea for mock meats more closely resembling hot dogs and hamburgers and adding more seasoning for flavor, including one Dr. George Harding, a relative of Warren G. Harding.
Oh.
Yeah, we're getting all kinds of surprising people in this episode. From this came the Worthington Foods Company and their two canned imitation meat products in 1949. If you're wondering, because we were, meatless wieners, still available these days if you're looking for a throwback, and soy loin steaks. Oh, that legitimately made me laugh.
It's a good pun. And we talked about these meatless wieners in our hot dogs episode. These were maybe the first veggie dogs on the market.
Eventually, Worthington's got bought out by Miles Laboratories, and from this came a brand you've probably heard of, Morningstar Farms. Yep, that one. They were the first that were really able to commercialize the mock meats market in the U.S., like the chick with a K patty, that was them. Morningstar went through several companies before once again falling under Kellogg's ownership. Seitan's success largely depended on the public at large accepting vegetarianism, which for a while was a tough sell in the United States, especially for middle America. In the 1920s, one of America's first chain restaurants, it was called Child's, attempted to transition to a full vegetarian menu at an affordable price at the behest of owner and vegetarian William Childs.
Ah.
Folks didn't go for it, though. Sales plummeted, and Childs was removed from his leadership position. Even progressive New York City was iffy on the idea of vegetarianism during World War II. Enter Cranks in 1961, an all-vegetarian restaurant that went on to attract famous fans like Linda McCartney and Princess Diana.
And I wanted to put in here at the end that these days, seitan is pretty widely available in supermarkets. But if you're looking to expand from seitan into fu territory, the fresh stuff that's mixed with glutinous rice, in Japanese called namafu, is hard to find in the West. But you can probably find a cooked and dried fu called a yakifu or yakibu in whatever Asian import market is in your area.
I'll have to keep an eye out for that. This episode has inspired me to try some more seitan.
Yeah, me too. I'm craving it right now. I've definitely had like clear broth Japanese soup that has these little, it almost looks like a little spongy cracker. And that's definitely this like yakihu, like dried. And I'm just like, oh, it's nice. It soaks up the broth.
Yeah.
It's a nice little texture difference in the soup.
Yeah. Oh man. I got a craving. I've said it before and I'll say it again. The tempeh episode to date is the one that has changed my diet the most because I eat tempeh all the time now.
Really?
I love tempeh.
Oh wow. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Oh, now I wanna like pick your brain for recipes and stuff.
Oh my goodness.
How do you like cooking it?
I like a good simple stir fry with soy sauce.
Oh,
that's
heck
it.
Yeah.
And a little sesame oil.
Ooh, yeah. Sesame oil makes all the difference.
Yeah. But now I'm hoping maybe I'll have a similar revelation about seitan. But in the meantime, it is time for
Listener Mail.
That was good. That was on point. There's hand gestures.
There were.
Coordinated. But it wasn't coordinated, but it ended up working out.
We're taking this straight to Broadway. It would be really off Broadway. But actually, before we get to the listener mail, we have one more quick break for you for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. And we are back with a letter from Jared. He wrote, I heard you were looking for food poetry. While not a poet myself, I wondered if you had heard of the poem Address to a Haggis by Scotland's most celebrated poet, Robert Burns. As a Scottish American, we celebrate Burns' birthday each year on January 25th. And traditionally, there is always a haggis as part of the dinner. There are all sorts of rituals and whatnot, and the evening is generally spent with friends and family reading some of Burns' poetry. However, during the opening sequence of the feast, Burns Night, or Burns Feast is what the event is traditionally called and is celebrated as a national holiday in Scotland, the presentation of the haggis before dinner is accompanied by a miniature parade from the kitchen to the dining area, during which a variety of tunes is played by a bagpiper. Auld Lang Syne is another poem written by Burns and then later set to the music we all know and love, and the recitation of the poem addressed to a haggis. It's a lot of fun, and since some of Burns' poetry can get a bit bawdy, there is plenty of laughter. I've included a link to the poem below for your pleasure. It's written in the Scots dialect of English, but this one includes a translation. If you haven't yet done an episode about haggis, perhaps you'd like to consider it. As of today, you can't get real haggis in the U.S. because of laws regarding the consumption of sheep offal, so perhaps it would be fun to research. I think so.
Yeah.
This sounds lovely and wonderful.
This sounds like the best kind of party.
A parade, a bagpiper.
Yeah, poetry readings,
the poem,
feasting.
Yeah, it's very good.
I've never had real haggis, but I'm into the idea.
I had it once, and I liked it.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was you had to get over it. At least I did, because I was pretty young at the time, and relatively young. And I had to get over all of the context, just, you know, in the U.S. we make a lot of jokes about it.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, but.
It's really just sausage stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was good. It was good.
I believe you.
But, yeah, if we should post the poem somewhere. It is pretty excellent.
We'll just have to do an episode on haggis and do a dramatic reading.
Oh, yes. So in.
Brian wrote, can you imagine mayonnaise on Hawaiian pizza?
Nope.
No. I wouldn't want to either, but nevertheless, I was witness to such a usage by a shipmate some years ago. I was working aboard a traditional wooden-hulled schooner where several crew lived in a rather dank forecastle that smelled of wet wood, sea salt, rope, people, and the more pleasant, to me at least, odor of Danish pine tar. I've never been seasick, but the smells of that boat, plus the sight of our bosun slathering mayonnaise atop her slice of steaming hot Hawaiian pizza, seeing it melting into the ham and pineapple, was enough to make me just a tad green. Don't get me wrong, I like mayo, but this is not an acceptable use for such a condiment, even one so versatile as mayo. I am from Connecticut and still live there, but work on a tugboat down south where the Cajun crew has converted this Connecticut Yankee to Dukes. Having been raised in the North, I had never heard of Duke's. Hellman's and its abysmal approximation called Miracle Whip were all I knew. But as soon as I tried Duke's on a cucumber sandwich, I was elated to find that it was less sweet and pleasantly tangy. Turns out these Southerners were right about their preference for Duke's, unlike their preferred treatment of lobsters by boiling them with crawfish seasoning or crab boil. Bleh.
Oh, I love it. Food opinions are so great.
Yeah, yeah.
Man.
Savor neither endorses nor denies.
No. We should get cards that say that. I didn't include it, but at the beginning of this letter, Brian wrote, don't show this to Annie, it'll make her feel terrible or something. And he's right, I got a little queasy.
Oh, man.
Hearing that description.
Yeah, that's an intense condiment usage.
Yeah. I've never witnessed such a thing, and I have no desire to.
I don't approve of warm applications of mayo.
Okay.
I think it's basically a cold sandwich-only condiment.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's Lauren's food opinion.
Yeah. I can see an aioli.
You got to go case by case, but
yeah.
Generally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've really got to step up the spices somehow if you're going to apply a mayo product to a warm sandwich. Or et cetera.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. I'm sticking with that.
We should really have a book of your food rules. I like it. I love this kind of stuff. Keep track of that. Thanks to both of them for writing in. If you'd like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@savorpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, all at SavorPod. We do hope to hear from you. Thank you so much to super producer Dylan Fagan. Thank you to you for listening. And we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.